welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Turn the Page podcast. I'm your host, Melissa, on her first solo adventure with a returning author who is currently the author of what is rapidly becoming one of my favorite children's series, which is Sherlock Bones. I'll have him introduce himself.
So, hi, I'm Tim Collins, and I write the Sherlock Bones series, and the latest of which is Sherlock Bones and the Horror of the Haunted Castle.
So, I loved this book. I love that we interviewed you previously with the Pharaoh's Mask, and yeah. That was very mystery as opposed to this one, which had that very big horror feel to it, and I'm a big horror person, so it was kind of fun to like delve into that horror-esque beginner's horror novel, and I love that. Was horror something you wanted to delve into with the Sherlock Bones series when you first started writing it?
Yeah, I mean, horror is an ingredient I would add to anything that I did just because I love it so much. But yeah, for kids, hopefully you want to have a bit of a gateway introduction to horror. And
we do it
very gently these days. I mean, when I was a kid, for some reason, they thought the film Poltergeist was for kids. So that was like the first horror film that I saw. They thought that was like Goosebumps or something. So that really traumatized me at the age of about 10. But then after that, I became a huge horror fan. But there's nothing that would really frighten a child in here. It just uses the horror tropes to add to the adventure story.
I feel like every horror fan has entered their like horror love somehow accidentally. Like I read Stephen King on accident in like the eighth grade and was scared for weeks. But now I'm like all things horror. So.
Yeah, I mean they said that you know being exposed to horror and reading horror from a young age would make us all serial killers, but in fact it just made us nerdy horror fans. I don't know which is worse, but certainly when you meet people that really love it, it does seem to be a pattern that they were introduced to it much younger than they should have been, and you know of course everyone wants that experience of being moved by art, and you know everyone wants Stendhal syndrome, don't they? And you know, watching horror films, reading horror books when I was young is the time I can most remember being engaged by anything artistic.
It's like that edge of your seat. So when writing the books, I've started to, as I'm reading, I'm starting to realize that you do have a lot of references back to like the original Sherlock Holmes, as Sherlock Bones' apartment is 221B Barker. And I know Sherlock's is 221B Baker. How much of that do you want to openly reflect the original Sherlock?
Well, I wouldn't assume that young readers have read the Sherlock stories. I mean, maybe some parents might be reading it with them, and you could put some in jokes in. So I wouldn't. I try not to go too far with in jokes for my own amusement. But the awareness of the character Sherlock Holmes is very good among children, I've found, even if they've never read the original stories. It's just one of these characters that sort of passes into popular culture, so they all know that Sherlock Holmes is a detective. And so if you're reading a book which alludes to Sherlock Holmes, as my ones do, then there's going to be some clues for you to look at and some sort of mystery for you to solve. But I mean, even in this Haunted Castle one, there is a Sherlock Holmes story called The Sussex Vampire, which actually plays out kind of like a Scooby-Doo story where, you know, they step into the situation where a vampire is supposedly attacking. And of course they, you know, Holmes gives the rational explanation behind the apparently supernatural event. So even this one, though it may seem as though I'm just slotting my favorite genre into it just for my own amusement. In fact, it does mirror, you know, something from the original canon. So you know, it had. I mean, this whole genre of kind of debunking the supernatural became very popular with things like Cat and the Canary and you know Seven Keys to Baldpate and all those plays which were made into films in the 20s and 30s. But it's there in the Conan Doyle stories as well.
So your small reference to Murder on the Orient Express in this book is kind of more of like if an adult reads it, they can catch that reference as opposed to like a child being like, ah, I get that reference.
Yeah, I mean, maybe one day they will read something like Murder on the Orient Express and go, that was referred to in that book. I mean, there was a generation, and I'm slightly before it, that was raised on The Simpsons, and when they saw classic films, they just saw the things that had been they were like, oh, that's what that bit of The Simpsons was. So it was like a kind of delayed joke that went on over the next couple of decades, really. You know, and I'm sure there's people who've never seen 2001 that have watched Barbie and didn't know what the intro to that was all about. Then they'll watch it one day, hopefully, and they'll see, oh, okay, so that was the joke. So yeah, maybe you can refer to something before someone really knows what it is, and one day they'll remember it. I mean, an example from my childhood, there was a cartoon called Danger Mouse, and I didn't realize it was parodying a program called Danger Man, which was the Patrick McGoohan show he did before The Prisoner. So sometimes you can, you know, as a child, you can read something which is openly a parody of something else, but just be completely unaware of what that thing was.
It's like everyone always talks about like how the Lion King is like a reference to Hamlet, and like no child has seen Hamlet, but as soon as they read Hamlet at school, they get that reference.
I hope they make the links to the Lion Kings. It's the sort of thing you could say to a class to engage them in it, and they'll have memories of the Lion King. I mean, there's no real sort of equivalent of Timon and Pumbaa in Hamlet, is it? It's not like a direct sort of adaptation of it. It's a very loose one.
So throughout the book, you have a lot of animal-esque references to places. So like the Carpathian Mountains are obviously a reference to the Carpathian Mountains. How do you come up with these names of these places? Do you kind of like sit there one day and you're like, this is a great reference, and you just kind of write it down for future reference? Or is it like during your writing that you somehow come up with it?
I mean, it's not too hard to come up with puns, really. You've got to not do too many of them, because make it hard for translating it into foreign language. You've got to try and resist it, but I'm not very good at resisting it. I worked in advertising for a while, and a lot of ad agencies had a no puns rule, because they're saying, you know, why would a client pay you to do puns when anyone can do puns? You can do sort of puns in the pub and stuff, but you know, there is something satisfying about, you know, a pun, and I can't resist it in children's books. But yeah, if the whole thing was puns, then it would be no use to a foreign publisher, because how can you translate pun after pun?
Have you gone to any of these places you've written about? I know we talked about Egypt in the previous interview, and this time it's in place in Transylvania. Have you visited any of these places?
I've not been to Transylvania. I have been to Egypt. I went to the pyramids in the days when you could still just climb them if you wanted to. So I think now they're a bit more cordoned off, aren't they? But yeah, I love going to the pyramids. I wish I could go back there in Giza. Let me think where the other. Well, the next book is set in Manhattan. So I've been there. So and obviously there's lots of puns, like Catcher of Liberty, on the way. But yeah, well, the first one's in London, which is very near to where I live, so I have been there. I've not really. I mean, the next one was sort of set between Germany and France, which I've been to, and I've taken trains there, but I've not taken an exciting train or an express type train. I've been interrailing, so I've been. So yeah, I suppose except for Transylvania, I have been to the settings of the books.
That sounds. Did you remember a lot of your travels, and that made it easier to write about those locations, or was it just kind of like you can do research on it pretty easily?
Yeah, I mean, I just tend to use Google Images. I mean, people do it in a different way. If I'm just describing somewhere, even if I've been there, I'll just look at lots of Google Images of it, and hopefully the memory of it will come back to me. I mean, I traveled a lot when I was younger, and then I had some sense when I was doing that of this might be useful one day, because I might be interested in all this stuff, and it turned out to be true. So I kind of tried to, you know, remember what it was like to be in all these places. But you know, I couldn't afford to go and travel and visit a location just to write the book. I met an author who did once. He visited about five locations from his book, and I was just wondering what advance is he getting that he can afford to do this? I see some weird tax thing where he's claiming it back, but I don't know what the deal was. But he sort of went around the world visiting locations for his next book. So who knows what the situation was there? But I don't think I could afford to do that.
No, this might sound like a silly question, but I know throughout a lot of the books, like this one, we openly knew that one of the characters was an Afghan hound. I think one of the characters was a Scotty in this one. What breed is Sherlock, though? Is he kind of like a mutt? Is he a be? He's got like that black and white Snoopy kind of beagle look.
I'm thinking of a beagle for Sherlock, but the illustrator John Bigwood kind of puts all these things through his own style anyway. For the Archie character, I was thinking of a Yorkshire Terrier. So in my head, he would have like a Yorkshire accent, which might not translate so well to US readers. It might not necessarily differentiate between different regional UK accents, but something about the accent just just gave me the character there. I imagined him as someone like Bernard Cribbins or an actor like that who was in Doctor Who when he was older, but he did play a lot of these kind of slapstick roles and when he was younger, and he was from Oldham in the north of England, and I'd sort of imagine his accent coming through for that character. So the breeds do kind of influence the characters quite a lot for me. Yes, I do. I don't just sort of randomly pick them. And I suppose if it's going to be a big scary dog, then it's going to be a Rottweiler or a German Shepherd. And if it's going to be a little yappy dog, then it's going to be a Chihuahua or something like that. So,
that explains Archie's fear throughout the book, because my aunt had Yorkshire Terriers when I was growing up, and those dogs were scared of everything. But then they look at you like, no, I can fight you. And you're like, okay. So that totally explains, like, maybe the accent, like you said, it might have been a little different to pick up on depending on how you're reading it. But no, knowing that he's a Yorkshire Terrier now, that totally makes sense why he's so afraid and everything like that. That's so funny. I love that.
Yeah, well, they would probably think of themselves as brave, wouldn't they? Because they have some bit of wolf memory still in their brain. But then when faced with anything, they'll just tremble and be frightened. So,
now, who comes up with the puzzles? I love the puzzles, by the way. Like, I'm 28 years old, and I'm just like, I got to do these puzzles. I got to solve them. I love the puzzles. Who comes up with them?
Yeah, I mean, I love puzzles as well. I mean, yeah, but I suppose we should explain to readers that might not have seen the books that they're a cross between text and puzzles. So every couple of pages of text, you'll have a puzzle, which will be something like, spot the odd one out, or a maze puzzle, or something like that. The publisher who does this, Buster Books, they actually print a lot of puzzle books. So they've got a lot of experience with putting them together. So I kind of quite vaguely describe, what sort of puzzle it will be. Mm. And then the illustrator, John, and the design department in-house are very good at making it into a real thing. But yeah, I sort of waste so much time. If puzzles come up on social media, I waste so much time doing them and stuff. I can't sort of pass them by without having a go. And I think some of these, I mean, some people have said the puzzles are quite difficult in this. Some of them are, maybe they're easier for children than adults. I don't know, but they're not at such a sort of facile level that you can just instantly do them and move on.
I was actually reading it at work. And so we got an online arc, and every time the puzzle came up, I was like, I can't do these via the computer. I have to print them out. My coworker. Yeah. I can't believe you have to print these puzzles out. I'm like, they're not easy puzzles, but they're great. I love doing them.
Yeah, I mean, any sort of 7 to 10 year old who likes puzzles will be able to do them. But I think a lot of adults might be out of practice with puzzles. But I mean, the publisher does do these books, which are just puzzles, and they are very popular, especially in sort of places where someone might be buying something before travel or something like that. Which these books have as well. Actually, they did well in the travel bookshops, because, like, if you're stuck at an airport or a train station or about to go on a long journey, it's the kind of thing that, because it's got the puzzles in there as well, could keep children occupied.
Yeah, I saw online there was Sherlock, Bones, and Katzen were in like a math notebook or something like
Yeah,
that,
that's right.
like
Yeah,
a spreadsheet.
there's times tables books and everything that
So,
you can get them in.
and I was like, oh, that's really cool. I like how they're like expanding and whatnot. So.
Yeah, well, there are some math puzzles in the book. I mean, not many. There's probably only about one per book because I know that if you've got a mental block on maths, then it can just put you off. But yeah, I try to include a couple. I mean, I love to do math puzzles. I've written a series which is coming out, I think, either this year or next year, where it's much more about maths and science puzzles because it's got more of a sort of explicit educational element to it. But these ones, it's kind of, it's just quite basic maths. But you think things like, choosing the stone which has got a multiple of seven written on it, like that kind of thing, isn't it? It's not like, Fermat's Last Theorem or anything.
Now, is it released in England yet? The newest book?
Yeah, so the Haunted Castle one is out in England.
Okay.
In the UK, that's been out. Well, it came out in Halloween, I think, that one,
Oh,
and
wow.
then I think the next one should be out in time for around right about May or something. The American one, and
Yeah, I think they're May 3rd here.
Okay, great.
Wow. But
So when the one that comes out that's set in Manhattan, you'll have to tell me if I got it right or if it all rings false like Dick Van Dyke. You'll have to tell me if it comes across as, I mean, to be fair, it's talking animals, so it doesn't matter if I haven't quite caught the sort of mean streets level of New York dialect. But that takes it in another direction as well, because there's a masked villain in that. Because I think if you're gonna set one in the US, the great mythology of the US is superheroes. So that contains bones and cats and battling against a masked villain called the Puzzle.
Oh, that's so exciting. And it's funny because every other journey they've done like a train journey almost to get to where they're going. So this time they have to actually fly across. Or is it like a would they do a boat journey? Because it depends on the time period.
Yeah, I mean, it started off in the first one that I wanted it to be sort of Victoriana, and then we sort of moved away from that just to get more exciting settings. Because at first I thought I'd set them all in London, but then I think the publisher was saying, well, it's more exciting if they can go around the world. So because of that, it's kind of gradually moved away from the Victoriana. And I was imagining in this one that they would have just travelled probably by train. Overland to it, I think, and then, but yeah, for the next ones, there's gonna have to be some sort of plane, some plane. I mean, I don't really dwell on it much because in my head, it's still, if not Victorian, then it's still like early 20th century. But I suppose it could be an early plane. I mean, there's an airship in the New York one as well. So that becomes like almost quite steampunk.
That's so funny. I love that. I'm very excited for not only this to be released in May, but I'm also very excited to see them journey to Manhattan and to my side of the
Yeah,
So.
well, there's a mystery involving the Statue of Liberty, and it ends up it goes as well to like vi the viaduct that comes into Manhattan across the Harlem River as well, because the villain wants to put catnip into the water supply and send the cats of Manhattan crazy. So Bones and Catson have to stop them by solving puzzles. But yeah, I
Actually, what
kind
makes her bagel so good? It's
of.
not the water, it's the catnip in the water that makes her bagels
But I think much as cats like catnip, a catnip outbreak on a massive scale would bring a city to a standstill, really. So they have to protect them from that. But I'm glad writing it. I'm sort of glad I had been to Manhattan and just spent a lot of time walking around there and getting the geography of it right.
great.
Maybe people who live there don't do that thing of just sort of walking around it for days at a time. But when you're a tourist, you do. So in a way, it gives you a bit of an advantage.
Well, that's like the Statue of Liberty. I'm born and raised in New York, never been to the Statue of Liberty. So I have
Yeah.
to go before I read the books to see if I can get like a basis of the statue.
Yeah, I mean, I guess all you need to know is that you can walk up inside it. Is it Saboteur is the Hitchcock film where they use the Statue of Liberty, for the end sequence where he's sort of sliding down it. So it's very much influenced by that. But yeah, of course you don't do tourist stuff in your town because it's always there. There's no deadline, so you think, I'll do that one day. Well, I went to Paris once and to stay with someone, and they'd never been to the Eiffel Tower, so I went to the Eiffel Tower with them. It's like the first time, which is crazy, but you don't really think of doing that in your own city, do you?
Please pick up from your library or your bookstore Sherlock Bones and the Haunted Castle.
Yeah, and the horror of the haunted
Horror of the
castle.
haunt. I always forget the horror. The horror of the haunted castle. This has been Melissa with.
Tim Collins, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and we are going to close this
It's time to
chapter.
close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.